household is on its summer schedule, which means that most every one of us is waking up whenever the hell we please, kind of a thing, you know? And it has given me a glimpse, Brad, to the life that I have dreamed of since I was in my 20s. Which is, I always, this is a long-standing dream of mine. I always pictured my cartooning career as I had no boss. I worked for myself, right? And the ideal permutation of that was that I could wake up whenever I wanted.
Yeah.
But then, Brad, I had kids.
Yeah.
And what that meant is I had to get up at 6:30 every day to get everybody out of the you know, dressed, breakfast made, into the car, off to school, this or that. Oh, what is it, a Saturday? Oh, there's a game at 7:30. Who scheduled a game at 7:30? All right, now we got to drive across town. That's also 6:30. And you have a couple decades of this as a parent. And I'm about a couple years off from the time when I can go back to my natural schedule, Brad, which is cartoon until 2 a.m., but wake up at 11 a.m. And honest to God, I know this sounds like a jokey schedule. This is what my body wants. This is what I've always wanted. I love working until the wee hours of the morning because no one's emailing me. No one's calling me. There's no distractions. I can put the music on. And then I love sleeping in. God, do I love it. I love waking up between 10 and 12 in the morning. It's my absolutely. And so I've had two decades of having to wake up at 6:30, but Brad, I'm starting to see the promised land, Brad.
Oh, it's coming for you. I'm telling you, and as somebody whose kids are a little bit older than yours, it is a unique feeling. I've got two of them at home right now, and one of them has graduated college and is planning on what to do with their life. And, you know, obviously that takes a little bit of time. But mine is just on the other side of that. Like, I don't see hide nor hair of either one of them until well afternoon. Like, two o'clock, you know, they come stumbling down the stairs.
When you hear the fridge door open, that's when you know they're up. Yeah, exactly.
Or I wake up in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning because I smell popcorn. It's like, oh my God, is the house burning down? No, they're just making popcorn again at 3 o'clock in the morning. But see, mine is just the opposite. I had so many nights of trying to get the comic done and staying up till 1-2 o'clock in the morning and then, you know, passing out and getting up and getting the kids ready that I've swung to the other side. There's nothing I like better than going to bed at 9 o'clock at night. Now I'll get into bed at 8 o'clock. I'm not ready to go to bed yet. I'm not ready to sleep. But I'm going to be here for the next hour, just reading my book, doing whatever, and then I'll go to bed at 9 o'clock, the biggest luxury in my life, 9 o'clock. And then I'll be up at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and it's just the opposite. Nobody's up yet, right? Yeah. And so I can work out on the treadmill. I can get working on stuff. I can do any number of things in the morning when nobody's around. And it is absolute nirvana.
Can I tell you, gentle listener, that I know this to be true because sometimes I will text Brad at 6:01 p.m. On the West Coast, right? 6:01 p.m. So it's 9:01 p.m. and Brad has Do Not Disturb
That's
on.
Right.
And I know he's already got his nightcap on and he's got the blanket like up to his chin with his little fingers curled around the blanket. And he's going, me, 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 me. No, I know that is true. So we are just built differently, Brad, but that's all right because today I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about sleeping at your own schedule and making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, the author of the Webcomics Handbook and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his well-slept friend, Dave Kelladel. That sounds bad. Cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
One thing you say about Dave, he certainly is well-slept. And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. I love that idea of across the party talk. Well, you know what they say about Dave Kellett? He's well-slept.
He certainly is well-slept.
Well slept. What's so funny about that is it has the intimation of sauciness,
yeah.
But all it just means is that you've just stayed in bed for a while. That's all right. So, Brad, let's jump right into it because we have a question that I love for both of us. So I'm going to read this off. Oh, coming in from patreon.com/comiclab. And this comes in from Skullhead Jones, who writes, "Hey, comics uncles, the wife and I have joked about what we'd do if we won the Powerball." And for those outside of the U.S., the Powerball is a big lottery. It's 7-8 states? I don't know how many states do the Powerball.
I believe it is. At least 8, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big one. And I'm curious as to what you guys would do if you suddenly won $1 billion.
Yeah.
Would you change anything? Hire a crew? Blow it all on collectibles? More projects? Just a fun thought exercise. Love the show. Bradley Geiger, what would you do? Would you ever work again, Bradley Geiger, if you won $1 billion?
If I ever won the Powerball, the fact of the matter is you would never know about it until long after I was dead.
Same.
Yeah.
Same. You wouldn't know.
You. In fact, for all you know, I've already won the Powerball.
Yes, same. Yes.
And frankly, because I kind of feel like I did win the lottery in a certain way, I get to be a cartoonist. This is the only thing that I've always wanted since the time I was like 8 years old. And, you know, I've been able to keep that going. So I kind of feel like I did win the lottery. The biggest thing that I'd probably do might be to hire an assistant or two and do that kind of thing. I think I would be very tempted to do that. But aside from that, I don't know that I'd do that much. I don't even think that I'd be that much into like moving out of my house. You know, like I like where I live. I like the city I live in. I don't know that I other than the top splurge, as far as anything outward would be maybe hiring a couple assistants.
Yes. So would I change Sheldon at all? No. Would I change drive at all? No. Would I change where I live at all? No. What I would change, like you, would I quit working? Absolutely not, because yeah. It's both my great joy, and it's also, I have had the recognition that if I retire, it's actually a form of death for me.
Yeah.
Like, I'll basically be giving up at that point, when and if I retire. So, I kind of want to work until I can't work anymore. I love cartooning that much. And so, yeah, I'm with you, Brad, on that. I think, now that I think about it, I also would say you wouldn't know that I won the right. Powerball, for one thing. I think there's a huge amount of wisdom in opening up one of those, not a trust, but what is it when you can have it hidden? Have you ever heard that before someone claims the Powerball, they set up one of those legal entities where it claims the Powerball, not the person?
Oh, no, I haven't heard about that.
There's like a list of 10 really smart accounting things you're supposed to do before you claim a big lottery win. And I would like go down that list before I brought that thing in. Anyway, so you wouldn't even know that I won. And also, it wouldn't change my daily life that much because if you guys know about hedonic adaptation, which is the idea that you are, your brain, your lifestyle will adapt to whatever amount of income you have. So if you have 100,000 past a certain level, so like if you're at starvation poverty levels, obviously that's different.
Right.
But once you've reached X amount of income of comfort, you're not that much different a Brad Geiger at $100,000 income, $200,000 income, $500,000 income. You might make a couple stupid purchases, but it doesn't right. fundamentally change your overall happiness levels in your life, you know? And I've come to realize that that's very much the case with my life, such that if I won a big Powerball lottery, I don't know that I could be much happier than I am right now. I love what I do. Yeah. I love what I put out in the world. It brings me a tremendous amount of joy and satisfaction. What I would do, like Brad, is I would fund more Dave Kellett projects where I'm a part of it, but I'm not all of it.
Right.
So
yeah.
I would probably have one or two books through, like, I don't know, Image, where I would hire an artist. I would write it. I might do ones where I might have way more Tales of the Drive, which is where I hire artists to do short mm-hmm. stories in the Drive universe, just because I'd love to do it. I would probably, if I'm being honest, set up some kind of foundation for younger cartoonists who I know are struggling, and I would quietly give them money in a way that like you shouldn't know about, because I don't want people coming to ask me for money.
Yeah.
But if I know that someone's kid is in trouble or this or that, you know,
yeah.
and they're putting out
yeah.
consistently amazing work. Why not help them? I would love to have a mangaka system where it's like five other artists in the studio with me.
Yeah.
I think, but I also love working alone. So I
was
going to
say,
you know?
I was with you all the way through the last words in the sentence where you said with me. I'd love to have them working, just not with me, not in the studio. You know, I'd like to be able to check in on them from time to time.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't want them in my space.
Well, honestly, one of the things that COVID did for Beth and I in our studio is we used to work 5 days a week together.
Yeah.
And it's not a big studio space. That was one of the problems. But in general, I think COVID just taught us like, oh, 99% of what we do can be passed back and forth on Dropbox. We don't need to be sitting next to each other, you know?
It's the whole, this could have been an email thing.
Yeah, exactly. So why have someone drive, I don't know, an extra hour and change in Los Angeles traffic to get here just to turn back around at the end of the day? Anyway, so like you, I think you wouldn't know it. I would remain fundamentally the same chipper guy that I am. But I would probably hire more people, more assistants, and more projects. I would definitely make another documentary because I have three sort of in the hopper, but they're, you know, they're $200,000, $300,000 propositions. Frankly, $500,000 if you want to do them right. And Stripped could have used, for example, better sound. So the two or three documentaries that I have in mind, I would do the Burns method. You know how he now basically has a couple teams. You know how for PBS, he cranks out like five documentaries a year because he's kind of the executive producer on a lot of these. He's not actually the one doing the final cut, you know. So I would run it kind of like that. What else would you do with $1 billion? But I'm also $1 billion. Most people underestimate how much money that is.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot of money. You could do. I mean, I it would be fun to have the kind of money that you could literally be like an angel investor for a certain number of people where you could see here's a person that's right on the cusp. They just need a push. They just need a little bit of grease to get over the hard part and go whoosh, and they would take right off. Right.
Yeah.
It would be great to have the kind of money where you could do that. You'd have to set it up anonymously because it would cause a whole lot of problems. Why did you choose one person instead of the next?
But yeah, you have to do it anonymously.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. You'd have to do it through some kind of closed loop system. But it would be because you do see people right now and you're like, you are right there. You're right on
the cusp. So close. In fact, you and I could name 10 or 15. And I bet most of our list, the Venn diagram would overlap a lot.
Easily.
You know, where if you gave them $100,000 and said, listen, I don't need interest on this. I don't even need to be paid back. This is just for you to finish that project or to start that project
or just
to leave
to set
that
them
job
up
at DC and do your own thing. You know?
Or to say, okay, you see so many people, they're just missing one piece of the puzzle too.
Yep.
I know a number of people, they're very good artists. They're not very good writers. And you could say, I'm going to team you up with this writer over here. Give it a shot for a year and see what you do. I'm going to take care of all the other worries that you've got. Give it a year, you know, or you take somebody who's a very cartoonist, but they just don't make good decisions when it comes to business. Mm-hmm. And you'd say, okay, I'm going to set you up with this person. They're going to steer your business for a little bit and kind of show you how to take off. There's so many people that are just missing a piece of what it takes. And it would be great to have that kind of kingmaker thing where you go, boom, now you got it, you know, and then just say, go see where it takes you, you know?
Yeah.
And if you're a billionaire, who cares if you get profit off of it or something like that? It's kind of a non-issue. You can just have that kind of luxury to say, I know what you need, and then make it happen. They would I would get so involved in doing that. I don't know. I might not, like, there might be a time in that scenario where I throttle back on comics for a little bit because I would get so wound up in tinkering with people because it would be so fascinating just to do that for a year or so and say, here's the part I think that's missing. See what happens.
Right.
Nobody's going to get hurt. You know, I've got everything covered. just see what happens. It would be absolutely fascinating.
I would also love to do, listen, now that I'm thinking about this a little bit more, $1 billion is so much money that there are possibilities that I have never considered that I might do. And yeah. I'll name a couple of them. So the one thing that I've always wanted to do is set up a cartooning program at my alma mater college.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go through SCAD. I don't want to go through MSU. I don't want to go through Yale or a cartoon studies program in Vermont. I don't want to go through any existing one. I want to start a new one whole cloth. And if you could fund 20 professors and a department
at your
alma mater, you could set up the perfect system. And I think that'd be fun to do.
Yes.
Because, and with $1 billion, I could also make it like, if you get accepted into the program, no tuition, that kind of thing. Like that'd be fucking amazing. Imagine what you could do.
You could hand select
the next generation of cartoonists and like really build them up into being incredible, entrepreneurial, independent, not looking for a publisher, looking to own and control their own work. I think that'd be super fun,
Remember that show we did where we talked about the cartoonist BFA? You could actually put that into play.
And I would build a little bit like the Angoulême. For those that know it, there's an Angoulême artist in residence. So I would do it, take a little bit from that, take a little bit from SCAD, take a little bit from MSU. Yeah. Hire away all the best professors, by the way, because you only need to offer them 20,000 more a year. And they're like, all right, here I come.
Yes.
And I would set it up at my alma mater because I would just love the idea of setting up a whole program. So that's number one. The other thing that I would do with $1 billion is I would set up what would essentially be and I know Image is akin to this, but a profit-free Image Comics where I and a select group of an editorial board would pick projects and people. And once you got picked, you wouldn't have to fund it. We would do it. Knowing that, like, and you could keep 100% of the ownership.
Right.
It was essentially, Brad, an angel investing for publishing, on the publishing side of things. I don't know. It's just like $1 billion is so much money that, like, you could do so many of these things.
Yeah.
It's so tragic when you think of, like, what Bezos and Musk have and what they don't do for the world. You know what I mean? With just the flick of a wrist, they could do so much. Be like, veterans that can't find jobs, not on my watch. Homelessness, not in a world where I live. Imagine what you could do if you had Musk's wealth. That would be bonkers. But even $1 billion is so much more than your brain can grasp. You need to see it physically. When you see a physical comparison of what $100,000 is, $1 million, $100 million, and then $1 billion. Yeah. When you physically see $1 billion, that is so much goddamn money.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem is that a billion. How come billionaires don't do this wonderful thing with their largesse? And it's because people whose brains work like that never become billionaires. You've got to be a really twisted, hoarding, selfish person to become a billionaire. Yeah. It just doesn't happen to people who think like you and I do. It happens to people who are absolutely comfortable stepping on a whole lot of other people to get there.
Agreed. Well, let's talk for a second about what we wouldn't do with $1 billion. I would not set up a cartooning museum, which is something that Mort Walker tried to do. And then the now also exists at Ohio State.
Interesting.
Just because I don't know that that's a need that needs to be fulfilled right now. Between the Schultz Museum and the Angoulême Museum and the Billy Ireland at Ohio State, I think we're fairly covered for good museums worldwide. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know that that's where I would need to put my funding. Would you ever do something like that?
I hadn't thought about it until just now, but you make a strong point. You make a perfectly strong point.
But anyway, so we would both keep working. We would both keep doing what we do. We would probably hire more staff. We would probably do more projects and fund more projects. And then, honestly, it sounds like you and I would both turn the money outward. Obviously, we'd get ourselves a better pair of shoes or something. I don't know, whatever.
Of course.
But I was saying there's always something. Like, you would get a slightly better car, Brad, or I would get a slightly better, PS5. Yeah. I don't know.
But it doesn't take much. It doesn't take that much. Again, with the size of $1 billion, it doesn't take that much to say, okay, I'm never going to have to worry about where my next meal is coming from. And my kids are never going to have to worry about that.
You'd pay off your house. You'd do that sort of stuff. Yeah, that's
and
fine.
But then that's kind of it. After that, you're on your own,
Yeah. Probably take two more vacations a year than you do now. And that's fine. But, Yeah, I can't. The good news is, God damn it, I love what I do. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's the big takeaway. I love my job. It brings me so much joy. I feel like I love the lottery. I won the lottery just doing this,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The numbers involved about how few people get to make a living doing this is so eye-opening sometimes, depending on how you look at it, that I'm like, I've already won the lottery. This is great, yeah. You know? Nine-year-old me, I get to do everything that nine-year-old me ever wanted to do.
This is, yeah. Well, okay. So taking this conversation full circle, I feel the same way, but the one thing that makes me wake up with my heart beating in my chest at 3 o'clock in the morning, if it isn't the popcorn smell, it's what if I lose it, right? What if this is the year that it all falls down?
When you say lose it, do you mean from a skill perspective or a money perspective?
From a money perspective.
Okay, like, yeah, what so if, that's
what
gone.
If the business
that's gone.
Falls apart, right?
Yeah.
But like, do you think that we get that way when we're billionaires? Like, what happens if I lose $1 billion?
What happens if I lose $1 billion? Well, Brad, at this point, you just have to talk to your therapist, because that's fucking anxiety, Brad. If you're still waking up at 3 a.m. with $1 billion in a bank account, that's just anxiety doing its work. That's not the money being actually making you nervous. I mean, listen, that's part of it, is that's hedonic adaptation. You just worry about the new thing, you know, right. More money, more problems. So,
right.
But no, you'd be fine. Here's a serious question, though, mm-hmm. about this, is that, is part of our creativity, even a small part of it, is it triggered? Is it honed? Is it refined by the stress we feel to make money in the world? And I'm being serious about that. Like, in the sense that, is our art made better because we're not doing the purely, oh, this is just for me. We are aware that this is for an audience of whom a percentage we're trying to get to buy a book, you know?
Perhaps I'd say that maybe that kind of I need to make this happen probably makes our creative aspects of what we do 10-15% sharper, let's say.
Right.
I wouldn't discount that in the slightest, in that we're always trying to be a little bit better than we were last year, because there's a relationship between that and our success that we've seen, right? There was, it took a long, I always say it took a long time for me to kind of figure out who I was as a creator. And that meant learning to be a better artist, learning to be a better writer. And then as my quality improved, I could see my business improve. So there is a direct relationship to that. And certainly I think what you just said is true. However, that pales in comparison to that same stress of I need to make this happen because it's an independent business that I own and everything rests on my decision making. I think that makes us 110% sharper when it comes to the business side of what we do, right? In other words, it comes down to that hustle that you and I always talk about, right? We may not be the best cartoonists in the world, but we can out-hustle 95% of them. And part of that is because from the very beginning of our journey, this was an independent thing that we were building. Mm-hmm. And so, like what you just talked about in terms of, does it make us more creative? Probably a little bit. But where it really pays off is when it comes down to laying out comics as a business. It makes us way, way, way better, way sharper, way more willing to do the extra work than anybody who found themselves as a cartoonist because they just signed a contract.
Right. That sum of money could essentially be like creatively. Yeah. Surrounding yourself with yes men. And that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that I fear that the art would become navel gazing nonsense because you're not at all trying to appeal to your fellow human beings anymore. You're just like, F it, this is for me. I got $1 billion. So to heck with what everybody else thinks, I'm making this nonsense. Like, I a little bit feel like they haven't been published yet because there's still some wrangling over it. But the books that J.D. Salinger wrote in isolation for all those decades, right? I don't know how many, there's six, apparently seven books that they're going to publish. I'm mentally prepared for them to be fucking nonsense because he didn't have anybody to answer to. And he was also a little bit bonkers on his own. So the fact that he was basically the money gave him permanent yes men status, right? Because he had no one to say, well, hey, JD, maybe let's change this paragraph and move this over here. He could do whatever he wanted. And he didn't have any feedback loop on the art that he was creating. I might be wrong, but I'm personally prepared for the books to be utter nonsense and navel-gazing, narcissistic pablum, you know? I don't know.
This is fascinating because all too often we hear people giving advice to younger people or people who are at the beginning of their journey saying, In fact, we've probably given some version of this advice. Don't worry about the audience. You just do what you like. You just do. We hear a lot of times, especially in humor, I don't care. I just try to make myself laugh. I hear that in humor.
I've said it myself. Yep.
I don't care. I just want to make myself laugh. And we've said versions of that too, because there's an aspect of it that's true, but it also has to be put in balance with the other fact, which is what we do is has a commerce aspect to it. And you have to appeal to an audience. You have to be worried about whether anybody is laughing along with you. It's both of those things are true at the same time.
Yeah, it's. You cannot fully remove yourself from the ecosystem of the readers that you're trying to create for. Yeah. And so if you have $1 billion and you have removed any sort of, I guess accountability might be the right word, Brad.
That's a good way
to
put it.
For example, I can think of 5 or 6 times in the course of my 25 years of cartooning where I either accidentally or unthinkingly punched down rather than punched up in my cartooning. Do you know what I mean? Like, picked on a group or picked on a person or picked on a personality type where I didn't need to do that. That was ridiculous. And I was rightfully called on it. Like, hey, Dave, I don't think you realize that that was a jerk cartoon.
Yeah.
And I had to stop and think about it. And sometimes it took me immediately and sometimes it took me a week or two where I went, you know what? They're right. They're right. I was punching down on that one. And that kind of accountability where you do still actively listen to an audience. I think if an artist loses that with too much money, you kind of become J.K. Rowling. You know what I mean? Like you.
Oh my gosh. What a great example.
You lose what shared humanity was making you great as an artist, you know?
And that may be a big part of what has happened in that particular situation. You know,
I don't know. That was a weird one, but every
news story you hear come out, it just gets worse and worse and worse, you know?
Yeah. And tripling down on anyway. So I don't know that I would be. The danger in Dave Kellett, billionaire cartoonist, is becoming detached from what is the shared human experience, you know, and that I think is a key part of making good, compelling, interesting, fun, touching art is sharing in that shared human experience. Right. Yeah. And that's why sometimes we say, like, even the most specifically drawn cartoon for a specific person of a specific situation, one of the reasons why it becomes universal is it touches on a broader aspect of humanity, right? So like I can do a very specific cartoon about, I don't know, being the son of a fisherman off the coast of Maine, and these are the problems I had with my parents.
Right.
But because it's so specific, it's universal, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The problem with becoming a billionaire cartoonist is like you lose touch with any sense of that shared humanity because you are emotionally surrounded by yes men, i.e. $1 billion, you know?
Yeah. Well, and just to wrap this conversation up, that's kind of what happened to syndicated comics in the late 80s and early 90s when there was just
what do you mean? How so? That's interesting.
Well, there was just a few of them. You know, there was a few artistic voices that you heard through it seemed like a couple dozen different strips. Like Mort Walker had a whole bunch of different comics that he was involved with. And there was a whole lot, Johnny Hart. And there was all those guys that had a whole bunch of strips, and they had, by the late 80s and early 90s, they had gotten, you know, a considerable amount of wealth because they had come up and made their bones during a time when newspapers were the dominant medium.
Right.
And as a result, all of a sudden in the comics page, you saw a whole bunch of comics about golf.
Yes, you did. You sure did.
And sure in the '80s, particularly, golf was still at that point very much seen as kind of a game that you had to be somewhat wealthy to play. There was a lot of places that didn't have a golf program necessarily at the high school level because it was something that a certain class of people played. But yet you'd open up the newspaper comics page and every other comic would be about, you know, a mashy niplick and hitting a hole in one and slicing into the rough. And it would be like, you guys have lost touch with the people that you're supposed to be talking to.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And I think, just to put a button on a button, one of the reasons why Schultz maintained his shared humanity.
Yeah.
Despite having a shit ton of money by the time in his last decade or last two decades of his life, honestly, I think was his lifelong fight with depression, insecurity, and anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So no matter how much money Schultz had, he couldn't outrun that. And that kept him grounded and in part of a shared humanity. You know what I mean? Because if you're worth $100 million, $200 million by the time you die, but you're still every night at 3 a.m. having the Brad Geiger sweats, it grounds you. You know what I mean? It humbles you. It ties you back to humanity in a way.
That's a very Midwest way of looking at it. But yeah, you're right. You know, it's like this trauma that I'm going through is somehow good for me.
Well, not good for him, but I'm saying was the anchor to his shared humanity that $200 million could have erased, if you know what I mean. You know? Hey, gang, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we'll tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And you'll get access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And ho Nelly, if you want even more comics goodness in your life, check out the new drawing show that we're doing with our pal Kevin McShane over at wrongwayshow.com. That's wrongwayshow.com.
In each episode, we'll show you how to draw your favorite cartoon characters the wrong way.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
Oh, wait a minute. What's that? Oh, there's no music. There's no music to announce Susan McTaggart coming in because we've got an update for this episode.
We do indeed have an update. So Susan, everybody, has fulfilled her contractual obligation. All the $10 backers have been gone through and they've all been affirmed and received lovely words from Susan. And so we want to thank Susan for coming in and fulfilling her contractual obligation. a thing that I always loved about this was Brad describing it as a contractual obligation. And so on that note, we bid Susan adieu and we thank her for her service.
All right. And let's talk about now when we talk about service, you got to talk about DreamHost, our sponsors for today's show.
What a transition. Listen, ladies and gentlemen,
I am the transition king.
Just nailing it.
And if you go over to dreamhost.com/comiclab, you can see a special hosting package they've put together just for our listeners. And you can see that you can set up a 3-year lock-in at $2.59 a month. For a starter pack that includes WordPress and all the trimmings, you can lock it in at 3 years. And I don't know that you're going to find a better price for web hosting.
No, I can tell you right now, you're not going to find a better price for web hosting at that. And also, given how happy Brad and I have been, and this is one of the reasons why we take them on so happily as a sponsor, is that over the course of my 25 years online, this has been the happiest hosting situation I've ever found because not only was it easy to make the switch, not only does the service have everything that I need in a host, but in the 2 or 3 times, well, let's not be mean to me. In the 2 times that I have messed something up on my hosting, me, not them, me messing something up, clicking something that I shouldn't. when I reach out to them in customer support, there is a human at the other end, and they are so kind about it. They're like, ah, I see what you've done, Dave. Yep. You're a good person, a really good cartoonist. Maybe you didn't realize. And they take me through how to fix it, or they fix it themselves. And in fact, on Brad's case, even one time, they said, hey, while we're in the back end of your system, we notice XYZ. Can we fix this for you while we're here?
Yeah. And they've done that for me a couple different times. And that's also how you know you're dealing with people on the other end instead of an AI. And I'm telling you, that's getting rarer and rarer is to find an outfit like this that has people working on those jobs.
Yep.
And instead of skimping and doing the AI thing. And that's where we're so thrilled about DreamHost. And of course, the other reason is one of the ongoing themes. Dave, I think we should probably talk about this. We're coming up on our 400th episode pretty soon. We're at 390 something right now. We're coming up on 400. And that has been 400 episodes where the golden thread that weaves throughout all 400 of those episodes is owning and controlling your own work. I don't think there's been a single episode that's gone by where we haven't talked about the importance of owning and controlling your own work. Well, in this day and age, owning and controlling your own work means having a website. It just does.
It just does.
There's no other answer for that. There's no other place that you have complete and total control over your intellectual property. And DreamHost is absolutely your best bet in getting started down that path.
So with all hearty enthusiasm from Brad and I, we're going to send you over to dreamhost.com/comiclab. Yeah. There are two plans you can choose from. The shared starter, the shared unlimited. Have a look at them both. You could do either monthly plans, year-long lock-in, or a three-year lock-in. Yeah. All three, frankly, are tremendous value paths to go down. But head over to dreamhost.com/comiclab.
Dave, while we're doing updates, I've got to put a little good word in for my friends at the National Cartoonist Society, the NCS, especially Jamar Nichols, who put together a amazing footprint on the show floor of the American Library Association conference. That was in Philadelphia this past weekend. Jamar set up for us to have this huge imprint on the show floor. I think it was like 3 6-foot tables by 3 6-foot tables by 3 6-foot tables in a square. It was a pretty huge amount of space for us to have. And Jamar kind of pulled this off single-handedly. He really did the legwork on this thing. I got to tell you, it was a lot of fun. It was a great group of people. Dave, they had carpeting on the floors.
They had carpeting. Speaking of being a billionaire and cartooning, what is this?
I actually met the event coordinator, and I think he might have thought that I was a nut, but I said, I can't tell you how nice it is to see carpeting on the floor. He started laughing. I said, you got to realize the way comic conventions are, they don't spend money on that anymore. So you're standing on concrete. It's echoey and loud. You've got a splitting headache by the end of the night. This is really, it's really nice to see you putting in that kind of thought into the experience.
Well, and in general, too, I want to give a huge shout out not only to Jamar, but to the NCS, because this has been the value add that the NCS has been looking for, which is regional free tabling for members at different comics conventions, or in this case, a library convention. This is the kind of thing where your annual dues as an NCS paying member come back in spades, right? Because I know they have San Diego Comic-Con, which is one of the most expensive and hard to get into show floors. Free tabling for NCS members in San Diego Comic-Con. WonderCon in Anaheim, which I can go to any year I choose as an NCS member. Right there down the road, bada bing, bada boom. I can just show up with a pile of books and plunk them down and join the NCS table. Tremendous value. You were able to show up in Philadelphia at the ALA. I mean, this, I think, is where the money for membership pays off in a big way.
Yeah. Now that's what I pulled Jamar aside and I said exactly that. I said, you know, back in the day when they were first trying to get me to join the NCS, my first question was, what do I get for my dues? What do I get in return for that? Was like $200 a year for a dues paying member. And I said, what do I get for that? And they'd always do the same bullshit thing. They'd say, Brad, you'll get out of it what you put into it. I said,
and you would say, I put in $200.
Yeah.
I would like to get out.
I would like to get $200 worth of value. Where's that coming from? If I'm putting my $200 plus extra to get something, then that's not a good deal. And so for the longest time, I was not a member because that was a bullshit answer. And I knew it, right? You get out of it when you put into it. Well, now people like, and this has been going on for a few years now. We've got to tip our hat to people like Jason Chatfield, who was the president before, Karen Evans, who's the president now, and chapter leaders, regional chapter leaders like our friend Jamar. They've really done a lot of hard work. They're not getting paid for this. And I know Jamar volunteered hours of his time to make this happen. Doesn't just happen otherwise. He volunteered hours of his time. And as a result, like I've already, as of July, made back my dues several times over. I already had one show in Philadelphia in the spring where I basically hit break even with what I sold at the show. Mm-hmm. And just that table that I had at the ALA convention, I never looked it up. So I don't know the exact numbers, but I've been doing conventions for long enough to know that that little table that I had there was probably between $700 and $1,000. If I would have bought that like an Artist Alley. So getting that kind of value in return, and then anything that I sold at the show was on top of that, getting that kind of value. And in addition, the networking, the meetups that they do in person and on Zoom. Not too long ago, they had Sergio Aragonés do a studio tour on Zoom, and it was the most delightful, charming hour that you could have spent in front of your laptop, just as he's showing you things. And of course, the guy's the guy's avuncular and happy and bubbly and just wonderful. But the networking opportunities, the opportunities to learn from some of the people that are out there who have different stories to tell. It really is something else. I've gotta really give props to the folks over at the NCS for finally answering my question, what do I get for $200 dues? I got all of that and a whole lot more.
First of all, I love that update. Thank you for that. Secondly, you used the word avuncular. Was that the word that we figured out means basically like of the energy of an uncle?
Yes. Yes. And I'm going to try and use it now every third episode just to keep it going in our public
discourse. It's one of those words that
discourse.
My brain has never stored. But every time you use it, I'm like, it's so weird that there's a word in English that basically says, hey, this person gives off uncle energy.
Yeah.
Which and I guess basically is what this show is. We give off uncle energy. So that's
your common
this is
uncles.
An avuncular podcast. Yeah. All right. That's great. Well, Brad, I've got our next question lined up over at coming in from patreon.com/comiclab. And this comes in from Jimmy. And it says, Brad, I had a consultation with Brad and Scott. It was great. The only item that surprised me was my use of black background with white lettering. I grew up with architectural design programs where I preferred the black backgrounds. It's not an issue for me, but if it is for a majority of my potential audience, I should address it. I'd like to hear you talk it through, by the way. This screen has dark background. Oh, well, hold on.
Oh, you can read that because what that is, Dave, it's an attempted gotcha. What he says is, by the way, he's on his phone. This screen that I'm typing this message to you right now has white type on a black background.
Right.
It's a gotcha. He's trying to do a gotcha. And I'll address that right off the bat. The reason that is because it's a setting that you set on your phone. It's we don't have any control, Jimmy, on how you set your phone. And if you set it to have white type on a black background, that's fine. You can change it back at any time you want. But that's because you set the settings that way.
Yeah. But now let's talk about this in a comic setting, because you have seen an occasional rare comic, usually a horror comic or a scene that's being set in like a Doctor Strange mirrorverse or something, right? Where there's white text on a black background. This is normally called reverse text or negative text. And there's a fundamental physical problem with it in reading at length, right? Mm-hmm. So it can be visually striking, but this combination It impacts readability. It makes your eyes tireder. It slows you down in terms of the speed with which you can read. And for some people with like astigmatism or dyslexia, or there's another term like I forget what the third one is. But there's people that genuinely have trouble processing white type on black. Like it makes their brain do another step, so it slows them down even more.
Right.
And so, but in general, it's harder on the eyes. Am I right, Brad?
Yeah, it causes eye, as I said during the consultation, they've done a lot of studies back in my newspaper days. The Poynter Institute did studies on that, and it's got a higher degree of eye fatigue. In other words, you can use it in a headline, but to do your body text in that, where you're asking people to read that for a long period of time, it has a marked increase in eye fatigue. Now, Jimmy says, but blueprints. Dave, blueprints or his phone that you're reading white tap on black background. You could go on and find, I'm sure, maybe three or four other examples of white type on a black background.
Sure.
How come we can't do that in comics? Well, I'm sorry, but we don't read comics the way we read an iPhone screen, a tweet on an iPhone screen. We don't read comics the way we read a blueprint. We don't read comics the way we read all of those other things. Your eye is doing a whole lot more than just going across and down and across and down and across and down when you're reading a comic. In a comic, you're reading that text. Your eye is darting down to the illustration. Your eye is following the composition of that illustration, reading any more text. Then your eye is going over to the next panel. Then it's going up and down and across and over and a loop and then up and down. And then and then you're zigzagging. Your eye is doing a lot more in a comic than it does in a lot of those other places that you might see white type on a black background. There's also, if you take a look at a tweet or something like that, you can see there's a lot of spacing issues that they are doing to contribute to trying to address that situation. But it's mostly you're just reading straight type across. Comics require you to do a whole lot more, which is why, if you're going to look at making your comic as legible, as readable as it possibly can be, you're going to have a hard time doing better than that old try. And by the way, it's a reason that people have been doing it for over 100 years of comics history, because it works. Black type on a white background is just the easiest to read, period. And that hasn't changed in 100 years. And it's not going to change next Thursday.
Yeah. And listen, does projected light versus printed light in terms of reading, does it make a difference? Yes, there is an argument for that. But again, it's still in small chunks and it's not embedded within a larger visual layout of a comic, as Brad was saying, which is interpretation of line work and color and dimension and shape. So basically what's happening when you're reading light text on a dark background, your pupils have to physically dilate. They have to become larger to let more light in. And so what happens then is that it becomes harder to focus on the text itself. And so for some people, older people, people with astigmatisms, and frankly, even normal people who are maybe tired if they didn't get a good night's sleep, that can cause slightly blurry vision and slightly blurry letter forms, makes it harder to read. It slows you down. So your visual acuity is actually not as sharp when it comes to light text on black backgrounds or dark backgrounds over a long period of time. So yes, in short bursts, it works, and it actually works great. Yeah. So I will make an argument that this is absolutely a tool in your toolkit as a cartoonist. So when you need to have on a page where, let's say it's a James Bond page of comics, right? And the evil villain is like, he's doing like banter with Bond as he has him strapped to a laser table, right? Yeah. The final panel, the final phrase from the villain, that single phrase, no, right. Mr. Bond, I intend you to die. That can be white text on a black background or a dark background, because that's the visual hit that, like, no, this is the killer move text-wise that you're hitting home. So I tend to use white text in a black background or a dark background, much like I use a sound effects font You can't use it all the time. You can't use it as a body text, but you can use it when you need a special hit. Right, Brad?
Yeah, absolutely. In other words, it's a seasoning. It's like
salt.
It's
a seasoning. Yes.
It's like
salt.
Yes,
Brad Geiger, it's a seasoning.
You can sprinkle it here and there as a seasoning to get it to really spice up your dish, but you wouldn't want to give somebody a steady diet of nothing but salt, right?
Right.
They die.
Right. Yes, that's exactly true.
So this is like so many other things, like specialty fonts or having a character who speaks in a different font than everybody else. Those are all seasonings. And any good cook knows that you use seasonings sparingly.
It's one of my longstanding critiques of the beautifully drawn Pogo comic strip, which no one can argue with is one of the most beautifully magnificently drawn comic strips of all time. But the problem with Pogo is he didn't use text and language as a seasoning.
Right.
He used it in every goddamn word balloon. And it made it exhausting to read Pogo at length. Like, yes, you could read it in short form as a comic strip and go, oh, that's delightful. You put Pogo in a book form and you're like, you're exhausted 3 pages in.
Yes. Well, I'm so happy you brought that up because I had one of those actually moments and I just decided not to get into it.
Okay.
But on Blue Sky, I did one of my conversation starters. I said, tell me the comics lettering sin that takes you out of a comic. And we got talking about, you know, those specialty fonts and fancy lettering that's hard to read. And somebody said the only person who could get away with that was Walt Kelly, who was the creator of Pogo. And the person went on to say, but of course, that's because he was Walt Kelly, right? And that's when I got kind of, I had my fingers on the keyboard. I'm like, actually, and I decided not to, but now that I'm here and you brought it up, it had nothing to do with the fact that he was Walt Kelly. The fact was we read newspaper comics differently in the 60s and 70s when Pogo was one of the dominant comics.
Yes, you weren't reading 20 pages of Pogo. You were reading an amuse-bouche of Pogo on amidst, you know, Mort Walker and Schultz and everybody. Like, they were all on a page together. Yep. And then when you got to Pogo, it was three panels of weird text that was an amuse-bouche. It was a seasoning on that page, right? It wasn't 20 pages of that nonsense that tires you out.
And not only that, but it was going to be there tomorrow and the next day and the next day. Yep. And it was a part of a total of 20 comics that if you were a comics reader, you were exposed to that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So it didn't have to earn its audience every day the way you and I do. And so we had a whole lot more tolerance for something like that. Like I said, we read comics differently back then. We had a much bigger tolerance for a comic that did something like that, because we were going to get exposed to it tomorrow, too, whether we liked it or not. Our only choice is if you skip it, and you skipped on that, went right to Broomhilda.
Yes, right?
And then enjoyed everything that Russell Myers put into Broomhilda. That's fantastic. But that was the only choice you had to make.
And honestly, on a page where you did have Broomhildas, the art on Pogo was so compelling that if it was put in front of you every day, you're like, I'm going to plow through this text to figure out what this beautiful artwork means, you know? Unlike Apartment 3G, where Dave Kelt would go, skip every day, because neither the art nor the text was compelling. Like, the artwork on Pogo was so GD compelling that you're like, I'm willing to plow through this weird Southern regionalism that's written in a Gothic font. Why am I reading this? This is miserable. But the art was so good that you're like, I'm going to plow through it.
As opposed to today's audience, which has a unending smorgasbord on a never-ending conveyor belt of content. You couldn't draw two more diametrically opposed systems. Today's audience has so much stuff that if they can't read your stuff in a split second, swipe, you're gone. You did not earn their eyeballs that day, and you're less likely to even get in front of their eyeballs tomorrow.
Yeah. So let's wrap this up with a bow. So white type on black text, absolutely usable as Brad said, a seasoning, or as I would say, an amuse-bouche of couscous in your comic, right? You don't want to use a lot of it. You just want to use a sprinkling of it. Has it been done where we've seen horror comics or a particularly moody Wolverine or something where they did white text on black? Yeah, they did, but they probably shouldn't have because, you know, it gets tiring by that page 30 where you're like, huh, I'm exhausted reading this Wolverine.
Again, I'm going to argue it's a different reading experience too. If you buy Wolverine every month, then if they do that on one issue, you're going to put up with it. But if you're earning an audience day after day, you've got to be a lot more hard-nosed about your legibility.
Yeah. So can you make this swing? Yes, you can. Will you lose a 5 to 10% of your readers who do not have the same visual abilities that you have? Yeah, you might.
Yeah.
Will you lose a further couple percentage of people that just don't want to read white on black? And by the way, they might not even know why they stopped reading, but something about it became unpleasant to them and they just stopped reading. And I'll be honest that's a percentage that you will never hear from. You won't even know they exist, but they will just quietly stop reading because for reasons they don't even know or understand, it felt uncomfortable to read your comic at length. You know?
Yeah. Oh, listen, that happens in comics. That happens in podcasts. After a little while, you get so tired of hearing Brad Geiger's foghorn voice that you're just like, oh my God, when is he finally going to say that you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and about making a living from comics?
Your hosts have been my foghorn friend, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evilcomic.com and the handsome new co-host of the new drawing show over at wrongwayshow.com.
And my close personal friend, Dave Kellett, the co-director of the comics documentary Stripped and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com and another wonderful co-host of the drawing show at wrongwayshow.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by the ever wonderful Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode. And don't forget to give us a 5-star review on Spotify, where we are burning up the podcast charts.
And Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So I will go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/I'm sleeping until 11.
When you sleep in until 11, what do you do for breakfast? It's time for lunch. You got to wake up and have lunch, and then you've got to have lunch for supper. And then by the time it's time for dinner, you're having breakfast.
Let me tell you, the Spanish have this right. The brief time that my wife lived in Spain and I went to visit her, the trick, Brad, is to just never stop eating and to always have a delightful selection of ham available and red wine. That's why the Spanish are so happy. You're just constantly grazing on delicious ham and red wine, and then you take a nap in the middle of the afternoon. After your siesta, you get back up. Oh, sure, I'll have a little more ham, a little more red wine. Oh, it's time to go out and visit friends? Great, let's have some ham and red wine. This is great. That's the way to live, Brad. The Spanish have it right.
That's an awful lot of pork. I'm going to need more t-shirts.